gentlemen. I love doing that. It just sounds so cool. So this is Dr. Arthur Barnes, your conductor for the evening. My name is Peter Curzon. I like to talk about music. And tonight we have several pieces that we're going to play for you. And I'd like to start off by telling you about Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, which we will start off playing. And the first question that may come to your mind is, why is it an unfinished symphony? Why do we call it that? Why do historians call it that? Maybe it was the case that when Schubert wrote this piece that he wrote as much of the music as he wanted to, and then he just quit and that was it, and that's what he called it. Well, there are a number of reasons why we think that it was, in fact, unfinished. The main reason is that symphonies of the form of the era in the 1820s typically had four movements, and the unfinished symphony has only two. And it was traditional at that time to have a third movement, usually a scherzo, and then a fourth movement to recapitulate everything, usually in the home key. And none of that exists for the unfinished symphony. And it was also the case that Schubert did not die in the middle of writing this piece. So that's another reason why we think that he simply chose not to finish it. So the question becomes, well, why didn't he finish it? What actually happened in his life to prevent that? Well, this much we know. He started writing it in 1822, and it's quite possible that he got distracted by other things that he was working on. The Wanderer's Fantasy was one of his great pieces, quite popular. He was working on that in the fall of 1822, at the time that he wrote the first two movements of the unfinished, the only two movements. And it's also possible that he simply stopped because he got sick. We know that he contracted syphilis at that time, and that would actually cause problems for him for the rest of his life. And it's also possible that he simply wrote two movements and realized that they were both in triple meter, and started writing the scherzo, which would have been the third movement, that was also in triple meter. And then he realized to himself, what am I doing? I'm writing the same thing three times in a row. I can't do this. It could have been any of those things. One thing that we do know is that in 1823, the Music Society of Graz, Austria, decided to confer an honorary diploma on Schubert. And so, as was customary at that time, and is still customary, whenever you receive an honorary diploma, you generally feel obligated to write some music as a thank you to the august society that granted you this distinction. And usually composers tend not to enjoy being obligated to write music. They often just throw things off as a knockoff. If you were Brahms, what you did was you would stitch together a bunch of German drinking songs and orchestrate it for the symphony and then call out the piece that you did. In Schubert's case, he could have actually written these two movements and passed that in its entirety to the society, the Graz Society. But what we do know is that his friend, Anselm Huttenbrenner, was the recipient of the music. And so he actually received the first two movements, as well as parts of a scherzo, which we know is associated with the symphony. And he did nothing with it. It's interesting that he did not publicize the existence of this to the Graz Society. He also chose not to have it performed. And so this has led to a variety of theories as to what was happening. Maybe he was waiting for Schubert to finish the piece and send him more music. But we don't know that because we don't have his letters, and Schubert didn't say anything about it in his notes. It's possible also that during all of this, everything got confused and it was simply shelved and no one thought anything more about this. Well, that was probably the case because we didn't even know about the existence of the unfinished symphony until much later. Huttenbrenner actually, towards the end of his life, he would outlive Schubert by almost 40 years. He actually made the existence of the symphony known at that time. And that's when the discovery of the torn manuscript was made. And the torn manuscript, of course, has brought all sorts of additional speculation to the fore. And the question there is, well, is that a manuscript that Schubert ripped up? Maybe he tore it in pieces because he didn't like what he wrote. Maybe Hüttenbrenner tore it out because of jealousy or feelings of inadequacy. Or maybe it was an accident. He actually thought he was doing something and the pages got lost and all these things. We don't really know. But what we do know is that at that time, this is 1865, Hüttenbrenner decided that the piece was important enough that it really should be performed. And he was advancing in his own years anyway, so he knew that as one of the custodians of Schubert's works that he had an obligation to make its existence known. So he let it be known to the leading conductor at the time that this unfinished symphony of Schubert's existed. So the music was given to one of the orchestras in Vienna. They did perform it in 1867, and it was an immediate hit. And they played only the two movements that Schubert wrote. They didn't play the unfinished third scherzo. What they did do is they finished with the finale from Schubert's third symphony, which when you listen to it doesn't fit at all. It's not even in the same key. It doesn't fit melodically. It's a totally different piece of music. But the audience loved it. And they said, you know, even though he only wrote two movements, it's still a great work. And we will call it the Unfinished Symphony from here forward. Two quick connections. The famous composer by the name of P.D.Q. Bach, you've probably heard of him, he decided to honor this symphony by writing something that he called the Unbegun Symphony. And he starts off with movements 3 and 4. And he puts in his notes, he says, the reason I didn't write the first two movements was because I was born too late. And the second thing is another personal favorite of mine, Peter Sellers, his last movie, Being There, if you've ever seen it, it's a very funny movie. And it's kind of a meditation on the desire of culture to have leaders, and anyone can be a leader. And so Peter Sellers plays this crazy character who eventually rules the universe, and they start the movie off with the Unfinished Symphony. So it's a good rental, and this is a great piece of music. I will pass it to our conductor, who has further things to say.
Well, obviously this is a hard act to follow. But I have other things to say, and to make sure that I said them, I have notes, or as my predecessor is, how do you remember all those dates? You just make it up. Well, we have two soloists tonight. They're going to play a first movement of a Chopin piano concerto and a first movement of a Bernard Crusell clarinet concerto. Now, if you're a clarinetist, you probably have heard of Crusell. If you're not a clarinetist, you're wondering, who the hell is Crusell? Never heard of him. Well, you've heard of Sibelius, and before Sibelius was Crusell. He was Finland's wonderful composer, a dynamite clarinet player, and a translator into 3 or 4 different languages of the then current operas. He was a big dude, did a lot of work. He grew up in Finland. He was born in Finland, but he grew up in Sweden. Spent 40 years playing in the Royal Orchestra in Sweden. I will talk mostly about him, not so much about Chopin. Crusell, well, let's put it this way. The flutes and the oboes and the bassoons had pretty well been developed as to what they're supposed to be. But the clarinets had not. And I have a picture at home that shows early clarinets that looked like recorders. No keys, just holes. 40 years, if he started off with a smaller clarinet, an easier clarinet, a two-key clarinet. You remember, if you know anything about computers, not computers, but recorders, right. You cover the whole, you play a C major scale. Now, if you want something that isn't in the C major scale, you have to use funny cross fingerings, altering fingerings. The clarinet started out in a way that way, but they decided we need to have all the other notes that are missing from the C major scale, so we started adding keys here, drilling holes here, and of course, it changed the tone, it changed the intonation, and even through Mendelssohn, way past Beethoven, Mendelssohn was still asking for a C clarinet. Now, what's the difference between they had, let's see, A-flat clarinets, A clarinets, G, F, B-flat, C, and D clarinets. Why all these different keys? Every instrument, from shorter ones, Ds, Cs, B-flat, A, G, F, they all had different tone qualities. And eventually they decided, well, we can't manufacture all these different instruments all the time, so we'll do a B-flat clarinet and an A clarinet, and unless you're terribly smart, you can't hear the difference between the tonality and the tone of a B-flat clarinet to an A clarinet. Why do you have a B-flat clarinet and an A clarinet? One just played all a B-flat clarinet. Why a B-flat clarinet? Well, C wasn't quite the right tonality. It wasn't quite the right tone, so we'll do it on B-flat. That's great. So if I'm going to play the Mozart A major clarinet concerto, I'll play it on A clarinet, which means I can play the C scale on top of the instrument without all those other cross fingerings and extra keys, but it'll sound in the key of A. If I had an A clarinet, it would sound different. So it reads in C, but it sounds in A. Okay, I'm an A clarinet, that'll take care of it. I just, who can bother about, you know, reading in the key of C, that's simple. But key of D flat, key of B major, five sharps, not good. But let's do it in key of C. Now, if you're in a high school and you want to play the Mozart clarinet concerto, but you don't have an orchestra, so someone figured out, well, we'll just move all the parts from the orchestra that were in A, move them up a half step and put them in B flat. So now the clarinetist come out and he plays the same written notes, C scale, but it sounds in B flat. That takes care of it. That's great. And that's as complicated as I can make an explanation. Okay? All right. Now, the piano that you're going to hear tonight, and the pianist you're going to hear tonight, who is 15 years old, and will be playing more notes than you have ever heard, unless you grew up on Rachmaninoff piano concertos. He is dynamite. He's playing on a playing on a piano that basically was built in 1875. From there on, from 1875, the piano has pretty much stayed the same. Beethoven piano didn't have all the keys that we have, didn't have all of the 88 keys we have on a normal piano. It sounded a little bit different too, but Steinway finally came up with the 1875, I'm using that as a sort of usual year, and it stayed pretty much the same in all the pianos from then on really have been like the Steinway, the Baldwins, the Chickerings, the Toyotas, is that right? Yamahas, okay, Kawais, whatever. They still look back to what Steinway came up with. And then Steinway started really in, for our purposes, started in New York City. His brother stayed over in Hamburg and made similar pianos over there. Chopin, this is the second piano concerto. Well, it isn't really. Now there are two sets of terms here. Next concert, we're going to be doing a New World Symphony. And I have an old score that says Dvorak New World Symphony number 5. But if I have a new score, it says number 9. There are two sets of terms here. One is to when the music was written, and one is to when it was printed. So, the Chopin concerto we're going to hear tonight is named number 2, but it was really, it was the first one that he wrote, but it was the second one that was printed. Don't go there. That Beethoven had the same problem between the first and second concertos. Being a child of the romantic movement, that right hand has an awful lot of notes to play. He is ornamenting every other note you can find on the piano. So I'm having a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. I'm having a little trouble sometimes finding out when is he going to get through with all of these notes so we can cross the bar line together. But it's rare rubato, robbed time. It isn't click, 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 which the Roussel will be. You'll see that when he plays, he's going to be playing. It's very metronomic, but wonderful. And you'll sense some bit of Beethoven in there, because he is the same period of Beethoven. Beethoven was born 1770. Roussel was born 5 years later. You do the math. And we're going to have a lot of fun with that. Now, he's going to talk some more. When I come back, I'm going to talk to you about something I've wanted to talk to you for a long, long time. And it has to do with what does the audience do when the music is going on?
One of the additional pieces that we will also play tonight is the Aaron Copland Lincoln portrait on your program. And Copland, being the towering figure of American music that he was, wrote a lot of stuff, a lot of great music, and we've actually played some of this in recent seasons. We played the Fanfare for the Common Man. That's one of his most famous pieces. The Lincoln portrait was written in 1942, and it was part of the war effort stateside to basically encourage everyone to get behind the effort. And it's interesting that in World War II you had this sort of thing. You didn't have this in any subsequent wars that the United States fought. In 1942, it was very patriotic for everyone, no matter who they were, to support the effort in some form. And this was true of artists and composers particularly. So Copland was invited by Andre Castellanets to commission a piece about, quote, an eminent American. And Castellanets, for his credit, was a figure who was mostly famous for arrangements. And he actually toured with orchestras constantly. He would put together his own orchestras and basically create symphonic orchestrations of popular songs. And so the name Castellanets actually became a brand towards the end of his life. People would associate that with popular music that had its roots in the symphonic form. So Castellanets asked Copland to produce this piece, and Copland's original idea, suggestion, was Walt Whitman. Because Copland, of course, is thinking in the artistic realm, he's thinking of famous Americans. Walt Whitman was the father of American poetry, the father of free verse poetry, things that didn't exist before Whitman came around. But the people who were funding this whole effort said, well,
you know, Aaron, we're trying to fight a war here. And Walt Whitman, yeah, he's a nice poet, but, you know, we actually need you to look a little higher than this.
And so he was encouraged then to reconsider. And of course, he actually wrote in his autobiography that the tendency or the decision to write about Abe Lincoln was, quote, inevitable. So he sat down, researched everything he could about Honest Abe, and then put together this piece. And it's a powerful piece. There is a lot of climactic motion to it. You'll hear a great deal of brass and percussion. You'll hear a lot of dynamics, much more dynamics than you'll hear in the Schubert, for example. And it stands basically as a testament to what American music would become. Copland, by the 1940s, was an established composer, and he was writing at a time when, quote, American music would actually be a subject form that people would start to become familiar with. And so he wrote this piece. He borrowed heavily from Lincoln's written works. The piece is scored with a narrator. And so what you'll hear is the narrator will be reading from Lincoln's works. And he does this in such a way that the narrator will read and the orchestra will play. And so the score for the narrator is actually written into the music so that the two can listen to each other. So the music highlights the words and the words highlight the music. You'll hear from the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. You'll also hear from the Gettysburg Address, as well as various addresses that he made to Congress. And musically, there are some interesting folk songs that Copland decided to quote. You hear a piece of Decamptown Races, which was a pop song in Lincoln's time, and also Springfield Mountain, which is another piece that was quite popular in the 1860s. And Copland probably decided to use Springfield Mountain because he knew that Springfield was the city that Lincoln came from. There is no mountain in Springfield, Illinois, we should add. But that doesn't stop one from using thematic material as appropriate. So, great piece, and it fits well since Lincoln's birthday was just a few days ago. So we're all in a very patriotic mood. All right, I'm going to pass it over to Art one more time, and he's got more words to add.
I'm going to read to you. And this is by Michael Steinberg, who, 25 years ago, when the orchestra had their big party down at Santa Cruz, he came down and talked to us. Now, Michael Steinberg has annotated programs for the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Minnesota Orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, and the San Francisco Symphony. So, this came from an earlier issue of American Symphony Orchestra League's magazine called, what do you know, Symphony. And he says, the sounds we make. When do sounds from the audience add to a performance? And when do they interrupt? Depends. An odd bit of theater took place at a recent concert in Minneapolis. Beethoven's Emperor Concerto was on the program, and a performance that had everything you would want by way of lyricism, intelligence, and crackling virtuosity. The way the first movement ends is unmistakably designed to elicit applause. At this concert, however, almost complete silence greeted those closing chords. Almost because there was, in fact, one single hand clap. But the author of that sound, apparently feeling that he or she had done something wrong, immediately retreated from action. The pianist turned and nodded in the direction of the solitary clapper, but it was and remains unclear to me whether he was being courteous or sardonic. The audience, though, interpreted his action as a message that they probably should have applauded, and they proceeded to do them heartily, whereupon the pianist stood up, responded with a full bow from the waist, and this is only the first movement. Okay. It was not that people hadn't enjoyed the performance. The pianist is well known to this audience and popular. He had drawn a full house, and the ovation at the end of the concerto was huge. Rather, it seemed to me that too many members of the audience had been told too often that it is bad form to clap between movements. That notion is constantly reinforced by soloists and conductors who respond to applause between movements by presenting a posture of, I didn't hear anything. I imagine that the smirking of orchestral musicians on those occasions has its effect too. This time though, the solitary clapper was quite right. And I was happy that when the concert was repeated the following evening, the crowd burst into applause at the end of the first movement. Audiences are so unpredictable. We seem to have forgotten all that. Applause in the wrong place is now a sin, like driving an SUV or eating red meat or smoking cigars. What happened and what does that mean? Remember in the old days, if you went back into the 19th century, where do you hear music? You either have to sing it yourself or play it on your piano. Otherwise, there are gobs of silence where there is no music at all. If you want to hear live music, you've got to go to a concert to hear the music. Nowadays, well, you know where I'm going with that, okay. They didn't have any CDs. In the last part of the 19th century, people became interested in the question of what held a large multi-movement work together, as well as the delights of its individual movements. One reason for this was the fascination with the very long-range compositional strategies in the operas of Wagner. Another was the appearance of cyclic works in which themes from earlier movements or sections had crucial parts to play in later ones. Theorists and critics often cared more about such matters than the composers themselves. Mozart and Beethoven no doubt took pains to make the various movements of their pieces be well suited to one another, but neither composer hesitated. Oops, I misplaced something here. But I will continue. And I'll start it with, on the other hand, it can go either way as well. In the Appassionata Sonata of Beethoven, you can't stop at the end of the first movement for brow mopping or applause or anything else. That last F minor chord, even though the harmony hasn't shifted for six measures, is profoundly restless, and the music has to move on into the Andante. But in the Waldstein Sonata, on the other hand, you can, without harm to the music, fling your arms into the air on the first movement's last chords, and even stand to take a bow if the audience responds to your operation here. So, it's okay. Sometimes you mustn't, sometimes you may, sometimes you should. How do you know which is when? In the 18th century, it wasn't a problem. You waited for your host or the highest ranking nobleman present to applaud. If you clapped before His Highness, you were being exceedingly impolite and you would not be invited to dinner again. Psychology of appealing to a single listener is very different from that of seeking to inflame an entire audience. And that is why Bach's Brandenburg Concertos don't end with extra temperature rising chords, but simply finish with the last note of the last phrase. That, however, is not our situation today, and the incident I recounted at the beginning fascinated me as evidence of how uncertain we can be in our relationship to classical music and its performance. To clap after the first movement was bad form at one moment, but 10 seconds later it was okay. Much of our concert life is determined by conventions about all sorts of matters. What performers wear, what the concert master at orchestral concerts make a solo entrance, walking on the stage or not, the tuning ritual, and what constitutes a normal amount of applause. Very different conventions obtain for rock or jazz, classical music, opera, ballet, and regular theater. Today we expect a conductor to be recalled to the stage two or three times, and I've done that, at the end of a concert. But not much more than 100 years ago, even a single recall was worth special notice in a newspaper review. In the last couple of decades, applause inflation has led to the standing ovation changing from a special and rare tribute to an obligatory event. But let us think about what the music itself tells us. Loud, flashy, harmonically and unambiguous endings are easy. And we'll hear some of those tonight. They tell us, clap. I would even go so far as to say that if the fever pitch seems to demand it, it would really be all right to start clapping right into the last long C that ends the Beethoven fifth. That is very rare at concerts, but we routinely do it at opera. That's what all those tonic chords at the end of a Verdi aria like Semper Libera are all about. German audiences tend to be very earnest about not disturbing the music. A good impulse, but it almost feels funny to sit in solemn silence through those rabble-rousing noises that are really not meant to be listened to at all. Once in a while, we experience the converse of this when a conductor starts the music right into the applause, welcoming him to the stage. I still remember the hair-raising effect when the 83-year-old Stokowski whipped into the Flying Dutchman overture that way. That can be exciting, but it is a gimmick that is to be used sparingly. In the quiet endings that cause trouble, and you'll hear these in both movements of the Schubert tonight, they leave us in a different kind of mood from the excited ones, perhaps dreamy, like afternoon of a fawn, transported to a far away private place, or Mahler's Song of the Earth, unsettled or dark, Tchaikovsky's Pathetique. A spell has been cast, then what? Silence may be the ideal response. Applause brutally shifts the focus away from the music, or wherever the music has taken us back to the performers, to a world of bows and smiles and embraces and bouquets. At the very least, though, we need an interval of silence before the noise we make begins. More often than not, a conductor, a pianist, a violinist, or whatever, can command silence at the end of a piece with body language and sheer force of personality. There is, however, no defense against the person who just has to demonstrate he owns the CD and knows when it's over. He'll shout, "Bravo!" before the music is stopped resonating in the room. Because this seems to be a peculiarly male obnoxiousness. Some music needs to be cushioned by stillness before and after. No less than sound, silence is an essential component of the musical experience. Silence is the canvas on which the composer paints. Might it help to remind concert goers that L-I-S-T-E-N, listen, is an anagram of S-I-L-E-N-T, silent. It is all a question of sensitivity, of tact, of experience, of the willingness to allow someone else to be in charge of the flow of events, and you can't legislate any of those things. Nothing, not even coughing, enrages musicians more than the audience's denial of that still moment in which to let the music sink in. Part two. Complexities of the cough. I mentioned coughing, and that is our other sonorous contribution to concerts. Applause can be iffy. Coughing is always bad. It seems like audiences are really good about all this. They know where all the rests are in the music, because that's when they cough. Less than 1/10 of the coughing at concert is caused by bona fide respiratory distress. For the rest, it means just one thing. They're not listening. Now, the word listen has become devalued. People say they listen to classical music while studying or doing their taxes. That's not listening. That's hearing. That's overhearing or half-hearing. I know someone who called some classical music thinking music, meaning music that allows her to think about other serious matters. Most coughing comes from inattention or out-and-out boredom. A Haydn symphony is as ingeniously plotted as a good crime novel. When it comes to gender, coughing is more of an equal opportunity pastime than premature clapping. But by and large, it is the men who dominate. Something I have found interesting is that most coughing happens in the expensive seats, an observation that opens quite a few cans of worms regarding the sociology of our musical life. I also find it remarkable that it does not occur to people, most of whom act with reasonable intelligence in other areas of their lives, that it is possible to cough other than fortissimo. But this, I have come to believe, is less an issue of intelligence than of morality. The loud, uninhibited cougher in a pianissimo passage, or worse, in a silence, is inattentive, unmusical, and unmannerly. Most crucially and infuriating, he is arrogant. Someone who takes it for granted that he is the most important person in the room, more important than Beethoven, than the musicians, than the rest of the audience. I haven't even touched on the plague of cell phones. Coughing is a singularly touchy subject, and more than one conductor has told me that the nastiest mail they get is in response, not to the playing of music of Schoenberg or Webern, but to their comments on audience noise. Hey, this is America. If you paid good money, you were entitled. You wonder, though, how did these people ever find their way into a concert hall and get mixed up with Mozart and Mahler? I think that's all I'm going to give you right now, except to say there is music such as Renaissance madrigals that is addressed primarily to those who are performing it. And there is private music, for example, like the late Beethoven quartets, for which one might ideally want to be an audience of one or two. But symphonies and operas and oratorios address crowds. The audience is, as it were, built into the piece. How embarrassing it is to experience the soapbox rhetoric of the Beethoven Ninth or a Bruckner or Mahler symphony all alone in your living room. Only yesterday someone said to me, books separate people, but music brings them together. When you do get the right audience, it is a beautiful reminder of music's power to unite us.
Excellent. Did you notice that phrase, applause inflation? You're encouraged to do that. I will mention just very briefly the final piece that we're going to play tonight, which is Howard Hanson's Second Symphony. And this symphony was written in 1930 to another piece of modern American 20th century composing. And go right ahead, April. So he wrote it in 1930, and Hanson's mark on music was that he was a music educator, first and foremost. And so the name George Eastman may be familiar to you. He was the philanthropist who started Eastman Kodak. He was a great friend of the arts, and he gave a lot of money to the arts, founded the Eastman School of Music, and Hanson was, in fact, the director of it for over 40 years. So this particular symphony that we're going to play tonight is probably his most well-known. It's one of his favorites, and it's a piece that has inspired a lot of imitation since. It was actually used in the closing credits of Alien, and the movie Alien 1979, Sigourney Weaver. And it was used without Hansen's permission. And he was not happy about it, but he chose not to fight it. Later composers like John Williams actually modeled a lot of what they wrote for movie music based on Hansen's symphony. There is one particular theme I want to call out. The second theme of the first movement is sometimes called the Interlaken theme. And Interlaken is a famous music camp in Michigan. Best music students in America go there. And in honor to Howard Hansen, every year at their program, they will play the Interlaken theme that Hansen wrote after the main featured conductor leaves the stage. And the student concertmaster will get up, conduct the theme, and then the audience will depart as an honor to Howard Hansen. So, interesting thing to listen to. It's a great piece of music, very lyrical, very legato, and it does befit its name called the Romantic Symphony. All right, that is it. Much to think about. Enjoy the concert.